Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining the Coping as a Caregiver conference call. Ms. Alicia Barron, you may now begin.
Great. Thank you so much, Claire. Welcome, everybody. We're so excited that you could join us for tonight's teleconference. We are really anticipating this call tonight because I think Dr. David Travlin will be able to tell us some really interesting things about coping as a caregiver. Dr. Travlin is a PhD clinical psychologist, and he's going to tell us a little bit more about himself when he gives his introduction right now. So, Dr. Travlin, please take over.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you very much, Alicia, and welcome everybody to this conference. I appreciate the opportunity. Most gatherings that discuss family caregiving for chronically ill patients tend to spend a lot of time talking about the disease, in this case, of course, MS, so that the caregivers can deliver better care to the patient. This is an extremely valuable service, but today we are not going to touch on those important issues. Today we're going to focus on the caregiver. The focus will be on how to prevent caregiver burnout, how to prolong the stamina of the caregiver so that the care recipient can be cared for in the home as long as possible. We became motivated to be concerned about this in part because we have been made aware of the fact that murder-suicide rates among chronic caregivers is pretty much an epidemic, and it's even worse here in Florida. So I'm speaking to you from a pretty unique perspective. I'm a clinical psychologist, but I was a caregiver for a totally disabled wife for 10 years. During that time, I received a lot of advice that was not only useless, but at times dangerous. I want to give you some insights today from the trenches. We couldn't find much information in books either that was not sterilized social or religious platitudes. That's why my current wife, a former caregiver, and I wrote The Tough and Tender Caregiver, a handbook for the well spouse. I want all of you to turn your, I call it a crap detector, but I guess it's a BS detector, on high sensitive as you listen to these words. Not everybody's going to agree with this approach. It's a very tough-minded and no-nonsense approach. What I needed as a caregiver was straight talk. That's what I intend to give you. Second, one needs to take these tips and apply them to your unique situation. There is no one-size-fits-all approach to family caregiving. Third, family caregiving for a chronically ill patient, particularly a spouse, often has moments of joy, but mostly it is a thankless job. To focus on the joys is misleading because there are not many joys to be found. I do not wish to mislead you. All right, I'm going to run into my a quick and dirty review of who I am. You have a right to, you deserve to know who you're listening to. I'm a clinical psychologist. I've been in private practice for 35 years. Next month I will turn 71 years old. I have a PhD from the University of Iowa and did a clinical internship at Yale University. I am currently an adjunct professor of psychology at Argosy University, University of Phoenix, and Post University in Connecticut. I was a caregiver for 10 years providing total care, and I mean total care, for a disabled wife. My wife, Rhonda, was a caregiver to an early-onset Alzheimer's disease husband for 10 years. She's a PhD candidate in human services. She is an adjunct professor at Ashford University and just released her second book, Who Cares? Who Says Men Don't Care? A Man's Guide to Balanced and Guilt-Free Caregiving. The two of us have devoted our professional lives to this cause. So I'm going to move ahead. That's who we are. First of all, quick review. Nobody seeks out the job of a caregiver. It begins because of a crisis. We all want what's best for our loved ones. And the thing that keeps us going in the beginning is adrenaline and hope. So we're hoping that it's not chronic. We're hoping it's acute. So we have this level of adrenaline, and we start providing care at an incredible rate. Now, once it turns out that we learn that the caregiving has to be chronic rather than acute, there needs to be some kind of an adjustment in the level of care that's provided, but it seldom happens that way. We develop the caregiving process develops a life of its own, and we tend to be on autopilot. We keep giving that level of care that is unsustainable. Tending to the patient's physical and emotional needs, is the essence of burnout, and that's what we're trying to control here, is burnout. Most of us tackle this responsibility cheerfully at the beginning out of love and duty, but it gets to be burdensome if we don't make that adjustment. Caregiving involves financial hardships. Well, caregivers will find that financial support is difficult to obtain, even when there is a payer source. Caregiving creates interpersonal tension in the home. Caregiving can be a lonely and thankless job, interrupted by brief periods of joy, perhaps. But we have learned that our friends tend to evaporate in case somebody intends to ask them for something. So we learn that this has social consequences that are quite profound. The other thing that we have learned, and we've done a lot of research on this, but we've learned is that much depends on the pre-illness or pre-injury relationship between caregiver and patient. I tell people that I was in private practice for 35 years, and I tell people that when they are not able to resolve their problems, it's like shoving issues under a rug, and pretty soon you live in a house with a lumpy carpet. And if you are living in a house with a lumpy carpet, and then the illness strikes, it's not going to get any better after the illness takes strong. We see the strongest caregiver relationships in the relationships that were strongest to begin with. The words of wisdom. I like this slide for those of you. Some of you can't see the slides, but I'm going to read you the content of it. But I love this words of wisdom that you hear from people. Well, things could be worse. And we want to reply to that, yeah, I could have leprosy. That would make it worse. Keep up the good work. You're stronger than you know. Keep a journal. Spend time gardening. Take refuge in your faith. How lucky you get to be together all the time. I never get to see my wife. Count your blessings. You are never given more than you can handle. Oh, really? We are frequently given more than we can handle. Not only are these wisdoms not helpful, but they're harmful because it implies that caregiving is forever. We need to suck it up. These kinds of wisdoms do not allow the caregiver the freedom to find ways to get their own needs met without guilt. Guilt's a big problem for caregivers. These little reassurances suggest that caregiving is a job until one of us dies. It creates pressures to stick it out at all costs, regardless. It makes the caregiver feel guilty for wanting some relief. For some people, they take this invitation to find hobbies or interests seriously, and it creates an artificial pressure on us to try to conjure up some kind of hobby or interest that we're not really interested in. And it potentially can make the caregiver feel like they are a bad person, especially if religion is not important to them. There's some what we call the deadly misconceptions of caregiving. And let me just sort of systematically try to debunk some of these ideas. One thing is that there's a saying and then there's the truth. Let me give you one and then the other. The saying first. Commitments are forever. The truth is no commitment is forever. Times change, situations change, people change. You can't say that this is forever, a forever commitment because things change. The needs of the loved one are more important than the needs of the caregivers. Well, that's not really true. The needs of the caregiver must come first, or no needs get met. It's interesting. Rhonda and I gave a presentation to a group of caregivers and the people they're caring for at a spinal cord injury conference in Tampa, Florida, here about 2 years ago. And we were watching them. The patients were in wheelchairs, and they were usually young men because young men get spinal cord injuries at a much greater rate than women, like from motorcycle accidents and so forth. And we said something like, the needs of the caregiver must come first, or they will not have the ability to continue as caregivers. And all the young men in the wheelchairs are nodding vigorously, thinking, oh, my God, somebody finally told my caregiver to take care of themselves or else they're going to burn out. another saying, a deadly misconception. There's something noble about sacrificing for an ill or disabled family member. The truth is, martyrdom only works if you're dead. Sainthood requires death. It doesn't work unless you're dead to be a martyr. Needs and wants are equally important, another saying. Truth is, not in caregiving. Full-time caregivers don't have enough time in the day to tend to loved one needs and wants and still have time for self-care. There have got to be some priority setting. There's got to be some triage, or the caregivers will not survive. Another saying, no one else can provide care like I can. Well, that's interesting, because the truth is, if the caregiver burns out, care would have to be provided by others. Also, I might make this point again, probably later, is that professional caregivers in a competent, decent facility probably are able to give better care than the spouse or the loved one or the relative. Another saying, it is wrong to be selfish. We're not supposed to think of ourselves. The truth is, the caregiver naturally are not selfish, or they would not be caregivers. The problem is, caregivers put their needs last and feel guilty when they need to focus on themselves. Another one of these old saws. It's so interesting to look at how these old sayings work. It is more blessed to give than receive. We all have an internal ledger, and when the ledger is unbalanced, we feel owed. Essentially, the brain has a mind of its own. I want to share something with you right now. This is a quote from a book. Actually, it's our book, but it's something that we wanted to talk about. Once we have invested in a relationship, we expect something in return. It's not like asking for something back is optional. That's not the case. We are all carrying around an internal ledger that keeps track of what we invest and what we get back. It keeps track whether we want it to or not, like an automatic computer. I'll give you a couple of quick examples. If you're exiting a door in a department store, and behind you there's a person with their arms full of packages, most of us will hold the door for that person. When we're holding the door for that person, we are literally performing a service. When we perform that service for them, we expect something back from them. I can't ask you to tell me what you think it is, because it's not a two-way conversation. So I'm going to tell you what it is. We expect them to acknowledge, like nod to us or say thank you some way. If we do not get that back from the person, we are annoyed. I mean, really annoyed. I'll give you another example. You let somebody in traffic by motioning to them with your nonverbals. They pull in front of you, and what you expect back from them is they're going to wave to you to issue their thanks for letting them into traffic. How do we feel toward them if we don't get anything and we saw the driver just stick the nose in the air and keep going? We're angry because we expected something and we didn't get it. Okay, our internal ledger is silent when there is equity between what we invest and what we receive. That is, when the subjective value of investment roughly equals return on investment, a certain stability exists and the ledger is quiet. But the moment an investment is either given or received, an alarm goes off, signaling a departure from equity. That's the internal ledger in a nutshell. Hold on, I'm going to take a swig of water. Now, what we get concerned about is these ledgers get out of balance, and we have something here called, where is this? I've got something here I want to share with you. Where did I put it? Here it is. Yes. There's something we call the caregiver feeling owed syndrome. This is an FOS, or feeling owed syndrome. And I'm going to read you some questions, and I want you to put a piece of paper in front of you, and I want you to just make a check mark on your paper when you're inclined to answer yes. I'm going to give you 20 questions very quickly. We're going to go very quickly. Here's the first question. As a caregiver, do you ever wake up in the morning and wish you had not? If you would answer that yes, put a check mark. If it's no, leave it blank. Two, are you beginning to dislike your loved one and feel bad about it? Three, Sometimes you get the urge to run away and never come back. Has it occurred to you that if you were sick or injured, that you would be released from your caregiving obligations? Do you often have trouble sleeping because you are so worried? Do you sometimes drink too much alcohol? Do you sometimes yell at your loved ones? Do you sometimes feel your loved one takes unfair advantage of you? Have you seen signs that your loved one is indifferent to your comfort and needs as a caregiver? Have your friends disappeared since you became a caregiver to your loved one? Is your loved one jealous when you leave the house to run errands or see a movie? Are you having difficulty carrying on a meaningful conversation with your loved one? Has your extended family cut back on their visits to your home? Is your loved one relying exclusively on you, the caregiver, for companionship? Do you find yourself eating too much or eating the wrong foods? Is your caregiving beginning to have a negative impact on your relationship with others in the home? Are you frequently depressed or in a bad mood? Have you begun to neglect your personal hygiene? Are you driving more carelessly since you became a caregiver? Are you feeling guilty for considering placing your loved one elsewhere for care? All right. If you've had at least 10 check marks, then you have the beginnings of an emerging problem that you need to deal with. Now, I'm going to go back to where I am, my presentation on my PowerPoint. Go to the next slide. These are still deadly misconceptions of caregiving. One is every cloud has a silver lining. The truth is sometimes caregiving can last forever, and it may not get better, only harder. This is one that some of you will consider to be controversial. In fact, you may have said a lot of what I said was controversial for all I know. We'll find out more during the questioning. Blood is thicker than water. Well, the truth is we think that's a bunch of hooey. The relationships we create are more significant to us than the ones we inherit. If you want a good, thick relationship with a relative, you have to treat them as if they were not related to you and build a friendship. That's something people don't understand very well. Another one of those sayings, the misconceptions, always tell the truth. Well, the truth is, oddly enough, sometimes the caregiver must lie to get their own needs met. You accept this as a reality and not feel guilty about it. Another saying, deadly saying, in a conflict, someone always gets hurt. It is best to avoid conflict. I had a little notation that I used to keep in my notes when I was doing psychotherapy, and it was PAAP, which stood for peace at any price. The problem is with that is that conflict can be constructive, and it leads to change. It's the origin of new agreements. I'm going to the next one here, which is love is unconditional. That the idea here is that if you love your spouse or you love your child, it's unconditional. The problem with this is that the only form of love that is unconditional is between a mother and an infant. All other forms of love are conditional. I'll give you, for example, with the marriage vows. What the marriage vows probably should say is something like this. I will love you forever, provided you do not squander marital resources, provided you do not beat me up, or provided that you do not sleep with somebody else. You see, we all have conditions on it. We just don't admit it. Another deadly misconception of caregiving. But you promised. Well, truth is, you may have promised, but circumstances have changed. You promised to always care, but you likely did not promise how you would deliver care, although some people do. We have had a lot of experience with children whose parents say, but you promised never to put me in a nursing home. Well, okay, that's fine as far as it goes, but circumstances change. Promises like that make no sense after the elapse of 10 years or so, and you're in danger of dying because you're giving your life up for your person that you're caring for. Things change. You have to be flexible. Another interesting one we say is, my loved one would do this for me if the roles were reversed. Well, gender is a factor, of course, in all this. But the truth is that studies that we've seen demonstrate that men delegate better and they accept help from outsiders much more readily than women. Women tend to take this as a personal challenge, and they are much more vulnerable to burnout because they won't delegate. They say, oh, it's my responsibility, and filial piety requires me to take care of mom instead of letting somebody else do it. All right, I'm going to go forward with another slide here. What about the vows? I just talked to you about the vows. We promised when we got married to people, for richer or poorer, in sickness and in health. Of course, we didn't know how sick was sick, or we wouldn't have made that commitment, or how poor was poor. We have known a lot of people who got so financially strapped that they ended up homeless because they were trying to be a caregiver. There's another little issue here that needs to be talked about a little bit, and that is I did marriage counseling for decades, and I talked to people in these terms, that when you get married, you acquire 50% of the voting stock in the marital corporation. The question is never whether you own the stock. You do. The question is whether you will vote it or give your partner the proxy. Now, that 50% of voting stock is all well and good when both partners are healthy. But when one partner is unable to hold up their end of the deal, then the contract has to be renegotiated. And because if you're the caregiver, you end up having to make decisions that you cannot afford to get consensus on. Because a lot of the things that we need to do for our ill spouses or our ill relatives or our ill parents, a lot of the things we have to do for them, they would rather we didn't do. So you don't own 50% of the stock anymore. You own at least 60% of the stock because you have to act like an executive. All right, moving ahead. Caregiving. We talk about the old way and the new way. The old way, caregivers get information about how to be a better caregiver. The new way is caregivers learn how to care for themselves first. The old way, caregivers are taught to learn about the disease or disability in depth to ease anxiety. The new way is caregivers learn how to make decisions and minimize anxiety by taking charge, recognizing that no one else has their best interest as a primary issue, but all of the responsibility falls on them. I have a little commentary here. Support groups leave the participants sometimes feeling worse. Because we've seen support groups where people get competitive. I can be a better caregiver than you. And when they talk about all the wonderful things they do for the person that's ill, it makes the other people in the group feel awful. Oh, my God, I don't do that. So be careful about support groups. Attending a support group is usually a helpful idea, but it depends on the support group. It depends on how they're run. It depends on the philosophy. You need to visit one and see how it functions before you ever join up with one. The old way is to seek professional counseling. The new way is we believe that there are only a small minority of professional counselors who know the first thing about caregiving. So you have to be really selective. You have to get a referral from somebody who is a caregiver and has had experience with a counselor before you seek out counseling, because it can be the wrong counselor can be a disaster, and I mean a disaster. My wife tells the story of being attending two counselors trying to get help for her problems with a husband with early onset Alzheimer's, and the counselors gave her religious books instead of advice. And she will never forget how she felt, that she just walked out of there basically empty-handed because they didn't really understand what it's like to be a caregiver. Okay. Moving forward. Ways to control the caregiving life. There's a little anecdote here I'd like to give you, and that is if you're flying in an airline and there's a problem with potential, you're at 30,000 feet, and there's a problem with oxygen, the stewardess will walk up and down the aisle and identify people that are flying with minor children, and they will say to them, put the oxygen mask on yourself as the parent first, because if you don't, you may not be able to do anything else. So this is the caregivers have to get the first oxygen mask, if that makes sense. Understand also that stress can be deadly to both parties. The stress that results from the feeling owed syndrome and failure to take care of yourself not only hurts the caregiver, it hurts your loved one as well. Stress can also cause apathy that creates an indifference. This is something that people do not tend not to understand, in our opinion, giving these conferences all over the country. The opposite of love is not hate. It's indifference. It is far more harmful in a caregiving situation even than hate. One other little tidbit, that is that what little research exists suggests that giving a government agency or a social service agency, giving even a little attention to caregiver needs can extend their stamina by up to a year and a half and keep them from having to institutionalize their charge. It doesn't take much. Caregivers are so much in need of support. Okay, moving forward. Guilt, grief. You need to understand what is a normal emotional reaction and what is abnormal from lack of understanding. We are all prone to feeling guilty about our loved ones, of not being able to give them all that we would like to give. Well, if giving them what we would like to give means we're giving ourselves nothing, then you're really doing a disservice to your loved one. Another way to control things is that to develop your problem-solving skills. They become extremely necessary that you become a good problem solver if you're going to be a caregiver. You need to be empowered to be able to make good decisions and to assess the situation carefully. Then there's this awareness of the internal ledger. The brain is a mind of its own, and the fact that there's feeling owed syndrome is such a hazardous thing. When someone, by the way, this is another thing that people don't understand. Every once in a while, people will say, how can I be of help? Typical caregivers stumble around and say, I don't know. Just be there for me, or something vague like that. Here's what we recommend. We recommend that you make a list in advance, and it contains things like mow my lawn, bring dinner, fix my sink, take me grocery shopping, that kind of thing. If you don't tell people what they can do, then they're helpless, and then you wonder why all your friends are not being helpful. We have to tell people what we need, or we won't get it. I'm fond, as an old marriage counselor, I'm fond of what I call the Great American Myth. The Great American Myth goes like this. If I got to tell you what I need, it won't count when I get it. Yeah, you've got to think of it all yourself. But if I tell you what I need and then I get it, it won't count because I had to tell you. You're supposed to think of it all by yourself. We fall into that trap as caregivers to some degree. We think that if they really cared about us, they could look around and see what you need. Don't make them do that. Hand them a list. Tell them what you need. You know, there's another thing that we have talked to caregivers about, too, and that's the possibility of throwing a caregiver shower. Make a list of all the supplies and tools and equipment that you need to be a better caregiver. Put it on a list and have one of your friends throw a shower. We do bridal showers. We do baby showers. Why not caregiver showers? All right. Let me move ahead here. Hold on a second. The other thing is that one of the things that becomes necessary for caregivers to save themselves is to be willing to renegotiate the caregiving contract. We talked for just a moment about contracts. Let me see if I can say this very precisely. All long-term relationships are governed by a master agreement. A master agreement, let's say, between a husband and wife, consists of hundreds of standing agreements. Like, for example, if I'm going to be more than 30 minutes late home from work, I'll call you. That's a standing agreement. It stands all the time. It's always there. And then there are thousands of one-time agreements. I'll stop by the store and pick up some cottage cheese. That's a one-time agreement. Thousands and thousands of those. So the thing that governs all long-term relationship is a master agreement. And when you are caring for somebody with a chronic disorder like MS, you have to have a master agreement. Even if you don't think you have one, you do. The trick is to surface it, to write it down, to think about it, to discuss it. It's absolutely imperative that we not fall into the trap of not being able to analyze the mechanics of our relationship. One of the things also that happens is what I call boundary errors. I have a little excerpt here I want to share with you. Growing up, most of us were taught some potentially confusing philosophy about our degree of responsibility for other people. We're told things like, love thy neighbor, lend a helping hand, it is more blessed to give than receive. Now, these messages were not accompanied by detailed instructions laying out the limits on giving. We were not taught how much giving is too much giving. Nobody taught us to limit the amount of sacrifice we make for others. What I like to think is we're all come equipped with a little 2-foot-tall picket fence that's about 2 feet in diameter, and it surrounds us. Every one of us has a little fence. Everything inside the picket fence is our responsibility. Everything outside the picket fence is not our responsibility. There are some what we call boundary errors, and I'm going to give you just a quick overview because these things really happen to caregivers. Either type 1, 2, 3, and 4 boundary errors. Type 1 boundary error occurs when I blame somebody else for something that's my responsibility. This is very common for teenage students who got a bad grade, they blame the teacher. Or the little girl explains why she hit her brother with a baseball bat. He made me do it. He made a face at me. The man beats his wife because she deliberately provokes me. Flip Wilson said it all. The devil made me do it. People commit type 1 boundary errors because they do not wish to be held accountable for the results of their own actions. They do not want to accept the blame for their mistakes. These same people are quick to accept credit for good things that happen even when somebody else deserves the credit. So we have to be careful about this. My marital situation, my wife's weight gain, she gained up to 400 pounds. And she basically said it wasn't her fault. It was her genes. It was the fact that her mother criticized her weight. I mean, she had all kinds of excuses. But she put on 100 pounds in the first year of marriage. I said she didn't want to be held accountable. So she committed to type 1 boundary error. Type 2 boundary error. These occur when I accept responsibility for the behavior of another person. Abused women frequently blame themselves for the violence. It was my fault. I knew it would make him mad if I bought a new pair of shoes without consulting him. Or a man tries to help his wife control her excessive drinking by hiding the booze. Well-meaning but misguided mother drives her son to school every day, so we'll not have to mingle with all those rowdy boys on the school bus. Those are type 2 boundary errors. And that happened to me, I must tell you, that my wife made me feel responsible for her comfort. So the classic story was she wanted to go to a mall, but she had tubes sticking out of her body in 3 places, oxygen, wound care, and an IV. And she just basically insisted that she had to go to the mall. And like a dummy, I took her. And it was a turning point in my relationship as a caregiver with her when I finally figured out, it dawned on me, I was being taken advantage of. And it was a type 2 boundary error that I was committing. I was allowing her to make me feel responsible for her problem. Type 3 boundary errors are less important here. They're another type of boundary error. Some people approach it's a combination of types 1 and 2. Some people approach relationships as if they were creating a new entity instead of entering into a partnership. they merge or blend together while obliterating both individuals. That's the situation where a caregiver doesn't want you to keep any secrets. The person you're caring for doesn't want you to keep any secrets. When you go leave the house, they want to know exactly where you're going, how long you're staying, who you're seeing, and what time you'll be back. That's a type 3 boundary error. Type 4 is when you accept responsibility for the relationship between two other people. A woman feels that she's responsible for the relationship between her husband and her mother. When her mother complains to her about her husband, the woman confronts her husband on her mother's behalf. That's a type 4 boundary. We have to be cognizant as caregivers not to get sucked into these boundary errors. They're just rampant. Let me see. I'm going to skip over a couple things here so we can get to the questions part. One of the things I would like to share with you is that my current wife and I were caregivers for a decade, and the people around us knew that, and we have identified what we call the measuring stick theory of caregiver relatives and friends. At least we don't have it as bad as Dave. The way this really played itself out is and I think this is an interesting story about why people's minds work, and that is when my wife, current wife, and I married, and we solved many of our personal problems and financial problems because we did, the people around us were not happy. They were not supportive. They lost their measuring stick, and they got very, very resentful. We got not one single card or gift the day we got married from any friends or relatives. Nobody wanted us to get better. That's something you'll notice as caregivers, is that people are not real thrilled for you to get better, isn't that a bizarre thing? I want to move on to a very important subject, and that's sex. This is a very prudish society, and these prudish social attitudes interfere with frank discussion. This includes professionals. Doctors and nurses will go into the next room to avoid the subject of sex. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to ask about it. They don't want to know. It's like they're as prudish as anybody else, which just blows my mind. Sex looms large in a caregiver relationship, and it absolutely has to be addressed. Oftentimes, as professionals, when we're working with people that are ill, we walk in and we hear a lot of sexual remarks or alluding to sex in a conversation, which is kind of a symptom of unmet needs. This is very interesting. We have some strong advice for people. That either if you're caring for a child who is injured, a child with MS, they're going to have sexual needs and it's unavoidable, and you need to not be shocked. If you're caring for a spouse, the sexual stuff doesn't go away. And we have a very strong recommendation for married couples who, in the case of MS or other chronic diseases, sex needs do not go away. So the way to keep caregiving activities from interfering with sexual activities is you do caregiving in one room and you do sex in another room. So you basically separate it by space. Many enlightened nursing homes encourage continued intimacy. My current wife, Rhonda, was a nursing home administrator for years, and she demanded that her staff allow doors to be closed when a person's spouse was visiting and stay the heck away so whatever they wanted to do, they could do in privacy. That's the case. In fact, interestingly enough, what we've discovered is people that are using what we call Plan B, which is they're allowing their person they're caring for to be cared by someone else. What they frequently discover is that their intimacy picks up and is improved, because they're not doing the caregiving anymore. They can focus on love. Strategies for professional help in the home. A lot of times we have people coming in to help us. here's some advice for you. Regardless of what your knowledge is or your ability to deliver care for yourself, when the pros are there in your home delivering care, you need to play dumb. When the pro is there, leave the room, leave the house, leave mentally. The more you demonstrate technical skills that you have, the less service you're going to get from them. Take all you can get. Be the victim. Get comfortable with it. It's showtime when there is potential offer of help. Do not be coy. When somebody offers, how can I help you? Grab it. Let me see here. I'm getting close to asking you what you'd like to know. Hold on. Couple other things. If you do some kind of facility placement, it does not mean that you just walked away. As we say in our book, you really have to continue to manage the illness of your loved one just as if they were living at home. You need to take full responsibility for what's going on. You visit frequently. You monitor what's going on. You create the right kind of relationship with staff. You can't just walk away. You visit frequently, and you take some responsibility for it. Let's see. We're getting close. Hold on. Oh, respite care. Caregivers need a break. And you gotta find some way to get it. When people ask you what can they do, take my husband into your home for 3 days. I've got to get out of Dodge or I'm going to have a nervous breakdown. Don't be afraid to ask. Let's see. Let me keep going here. You also have to run your house like a business. I think that getting some help from people who are professional business managers sometimes helps caregivers, because you got to almost be thinking of yourself as the CEO of your own company, which is your household. Let's see. Focusing on this. Here we go. A lot of information out there for caregivers on the internet. You need to be able to search and have internet service available to you. It really helps. Let's see. Take the feeling owed syndrome quiz often so that you can assess your anger level. You don't want it to get out of hand. That's when people do disastrous things. Ask for freebies. You can go ask anybody for anything. You can go to a supply store supplying medical and say, I am out of money, but I need X, Y, and Z. Can you help me? Avoid people. This is very important advice. Avoid people who make you feel bad. Relatives and friends who are not primary caregivers will give advice and offer their thoughts without invitation. And when you don't follow their advice, they can be angry because they're giving you advice based on their own motives. You need to just stay away from people who make you feel bad. We learned that the hard way. All right. All right, operator, Claire, I'm ready to take some questions.
Ladies and gentlemen.
By the way, thank you for the opportunity to do this. Go ahead.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you have a question, please press the number one key on your phone. Again, if you have any questions, please press the number one key on your phone. There are no questions at this time. Our first question comes from Barclay Burrow. One moment.
Sure.
Thank you. Could you please, first of all, spell your name for me, because I did miss that.
My last name is Travland. T-R-A-V as in Victor, L-A-N-D, Travland.
Very good. My question is, how do you handle the financial end of caregiving? Are the responsible caregiver, of course, you're running your place like a business and you have the purse strings, but what happens if the person you're caring for is not really in a good state of mind to handle financial issues?
Well, this is an example of where you have to redefine what percentage of the voting stock you own. Because if the person that you're in a relationship with cannot be responsible and is therefore harming themselves by making bad financial decisions, you have to just simply block off all access to money and take responsibility for it yourself. That's the only way.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, please press the number one key on your phone. There are no questions in queue, Dr. Travlin.
Dr. Travlin, this is Alicia, and I actually had a question for you. You mentioned you know, sex and also keeping your relationship and maintaining that intimacy. What are some other tips other than maybe, you know, changing rooms to help people really focus on their partnership as a couple and not so much as their relationship as a caregiver and care receiver? Do you have any other tips for people?
Yeah, thanks for asking about that. One of the things I meant to mention is that there's a lot more to intimacy than sex. I think you have to be willing to spend time. That, you know, this is going to sound like a phony feminist point of view, and it's really not. I've been doing this for many years professionally. But physical contact is critical. One of the things that I think men should be doing is washing their loved one's hair, brushing their loved one's hair, caressing them, massaging them, staying cuddling up next to them in bed. It's very reassuring to have your spouse to spend a lot of hands-on time reassuring you, patting you, and caressing you. Those are as important in a caregiving relationship as the act of sex itself. Also, I might point out to you that typical missionary-style sex for many disabled people is just not possible. But if you look into a medical equipment catalog, you see all kinds of marital aids that are for sale in sexual in medical catalogs, and there are just an enormous number of things that you can do to help with positioning, to help with stability. There are lots of creative things that you can do to be able to get those intimacy needs met.
Great, thank you. I appreciate that. I think if there's no other questions, is there anything else, any final takeaways, Dr. Travlin, that you have to share with our group tonight?
Well, I always try to end by saying that you really have to take care of yourself as a caregiver, or you are doing the person you're caring for the ultimate disservice, because it means that if you're not taking care of your own needs as a caregiver, you are limiting your ability to continue to give care. And when you do that, you put your loved one in a situation where what in the world are they going to do if you're not available? It's a terrible disservice to our loved ones not to take care of ourselves.
Absolutely true. Thank you so much, Dr. Travlin. This was really informative, and I'm sure many of our folks will have really great feedback to give you on your presentation tonight. For those of you who are able to join us on the teleconference, I appreciate your attendance. I will be sending out a survey to those of you who are able to join us to get your thoughts on tonight's teleconference and also maybe to learn about some other issues that you guys would like us to cover in future teleconference programming. And speaking of future teleconferences, we do have another one. The final one in our series for this fiscal year will be about our website and the National MS Society's websites and also our local state's website so that you can help you find some of our resources that we have available. Our websites are really wonderful places to find a lot of information and including the recordings of past teleconferences, which the recording of this one will also join those. So please, I hope you'll join us on September 14th for our Website 101 teleconference. If anyone has any questions that they come up with after this teleconference is done, please feel free to email me or call the National MS Society, and we will certainly try to answer all of your questions. Thank you so much, everyone. Have a wonderful evening.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes your call at this time.